This is KUOW's The Record. Welcome to it. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to begin this hour with the latest example of Washington State people messing with the Trump election, or at least trying. Next week, members of America's Electoral College meet in their home states to cast their votes for president. That's our system. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. Donald Trump won more electoral votes. Since Washington State went for Clinton, the tradition is that all 12 of our state's electors will vote for her. But two of our electors plan to buck that tradition, and they have sued in federal court to stop Washington State from responding with a $1,000 fine. One of those two Washington electors is Brett Schiaffalo. Brett, welcome back to KUOW.
Thank you for having me again.
Choosing not to vote for Clinton means you're breaking an agreement you made when you became an elector. It makes you a so-called faithless elector. Why are you doing this?
I believe the Constitution makes clear that electors are to do whatever they can to stop an unfit president from taking office. And I believe at this point that demands that I work with Republican electors to try to support a unity candidate who would be a Republican. If I was going to be the last vote to push Hillary Clinton over the edge, I would still vote for her. But the bottom line is, if I don't vote for Hillary Clinton, she's going to get 231 votes and lose. And if I do vote for Hillary Clinton, she's going to get 232 votes and lose.
So you're resigned that Clinton will lose, but how does your costing her an electoral vote do anything to block Trump?
We are trying to show Republican electors that we are putting country before party. This is some backroom trick to try to trick them into not voting for Trump. I have a great deal of respect for Secretary Clinton, and I think she would understand this moment in time and why I'm making this choice.
It sounds like you also want to inspire Republican electors to think, wait, I guess I don't have to vote that way.
That's part of it. That's especially part of the lawsuit. And I'm not the only one. I'm not the only plaintiff in that lawsuit. There's also Levi Guerra, who's an amazing 19-year-old woman from outside of Moses Lake who feels just as strongly about this stuff as I do. We both believe that the Washington state law preventing us from voting for who we believe is best is fully unconstitutional.
As it is, electors who don't vote with the will of the people of Washington state are subject to a $1,000 fine, and you are suing to stop Washington state from penalizing you that way. Why do you think that $1,000 penalty is unfair?
Well, it's not so much that we think it's unfair. We think it's unconstitutional. We believe that the Constitution gives us the right to vote for who we think is best and use our wisdom and any kind of knowledge we can gain to make the right decision. And we believe any state law that prevents an elector from doing that is unconstitutional on its face.
Does the Constitution forbid states from requiring you to vote with the people?
No, not in so many words. However, it does very strongly present electors as free agents. And most constitutional scholars who have studied this and reported on it agree with what we're saying here. Electors are supposed to make a decision based on the information in front of them and not based on what a political party wants them to do, and also not based on the popular vote. The fact is, the popular vote for president is never even mentioned in the Constitution.
Well, Washington State would not be preventing you from voting how you want. It would just be fining you $1,000, which you could raise on GoFundMe in less time than it took me to finish this sentence.
And you're probably right about that. But the bottom line is the $1,000 fine is just what Washington State has. There are states that have felony charges if you vote for someone you're not supposed to, quote unquote. And then there are other states that will immediately remove you and replace with you as someone else to fill in your vote. So while in Washington, I could still do that and raise the significant fund of $1,000, there are other states that don't have that option. And we believe that regardless if it's a $1 fine or 10 years in prison, they're all equally unconstitutional.
How did you react when President-elect Trump's attorneys filed a motion against you?
I was not surprised. To me, I'll be completely honest, it says to me that they're scared by what we're trying to do, and they're now nervous, because by acknowledging us, they're showing that they are nervous about what's going to come out of what we're doing, which means we're on the right path in my mind.
You and other electors have also demanded more intelligence briefings to look into Russian involvement in American elections. What would that change for you?
It may not change anything for me. I've come to a pretty clear conclusion about this. However, I want every one of the other 537 electors in this country to have the ability to see those briefings. And while it may not change my mind, I think there's a lot of people out there who may bring in stark relief the facts of the matter that Donald Trump may be being influenced by foreign powers.
Do you think this new wrinkle of Russian involvement changes your odds of victory? Because the last time you and I talked, Brett, you described your Hamilton elector, your faithless elector effort as a Hail Mary.
I don't think it's quite a Hail Mary anymore. The fact is I think more and more Republican electors, having thought about it for weeks at this point and seeing it pile on more and more with stuff like the CIA release of Russian involvement, I think they're having to recheck with what's really good for this country and what's right by this country. And I think our chances have gone from Hail Mary to a low odds play.
Okay, we're talking with Brett Schaffalo, one of 12 Washington State electors. He's not going to vote for Hillary Clinton, as Washington State voters did. Who will you cast your vote for, Brett?
Odds are I will vote for a consensus Hamilton candidate, a Republican. You know, it could be someone like John Kasich, Mitt Romney, or Susan Collins. Those are the types of people we're looking at. I may not make my final decision until I sit down in front of the table in that marble room in Olympia. But it will most likely not be for Hillary Clinton.
Okay. Well, you said that you still think it's low odds. If you fall short and Donald Trump is inaugurated president on January 20th, how will you look back at this effort, all the time and energy that you spent on it?
I'll be proud. I believe that everybody who's working on this project right now is doing what they believe is best for the country and the people, and using the tools the Constitution gave us to do that. I don't think anyone should look back at something they did honorably and something they felt strongly about to try to do something right. Regardless of losing or winning, it doesn't change the legitimacy or the ethics of what we're doing here.
That's Brett Schaffalo, who wants to break with the agreement he made as a Washington State elector. He plans to not vote for Hillary Clinton, even though she won the popular vote here. He and one other Washington elector are suing to stop the state from enforcing a fine on so-called faithless electors. A hearing on their request is scheduled for tomorrow. We'll let you know what happens here on KUOW Seattle. Also preparing for conflict with the Trump administration, the labor movement. The president-elect recently picked a fast food mogul as labor secretary. Andrew Puzder was a harsh critic of the Obama administration's worker protections. KUOW's Carolyn Adolph reports.
Donald Trump rode to power on the promise of helping workers.
Sorry to keep you waiting. Complicated business. Complicated.
Already, there are signs about how he intends to proceed. Labor unions are not the only ones concerned with what they're seeing. It sure seems a long way from election night, when labor unions in Washington state won big. Nicole Grant is the head of the MLK Labor Council, the largest labor group in the Seattle area.
On every single issue that we fought for during this election as a labor movement, we won.
I've just received a call from Secretary Clinton.
And yet it was impossible to enjoy yourself on election night. Such was the shock and such was the pain.
Our mouths are hanging open also, just like everyone else.
This is Paul Guppy, Vice President of Research at the Washington Policy Center. It's a conservative think tank here in Seattle. They push for free markets and less government. You'd think people over there would be thrilled.
I'm sure organized labor is very unhappy because they're losing the influence that they had before. I think that workers, broadly speaking, should be optimistic about economic growth and opportunity.
Actually, there's something about Donald Trump that gives them pause. That carrier deal the other week.
Companies are not going to leave the United States anymore without consequences. Not going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
Trump offered tax incentives to save jobs at Carrier. And that is not cool, says Paul Guppy of the Washington Policy Center.
It doesn't work as national policy because it cuts special deals for people who have political influence. And that's not real free market capitalism.
So not even free marketers are 100% happy with Trump so far. Labor unions, though, are deeply worried. Trump will pick the next Supreme Court justices, and there are cases coming that are all about union power. Trump's labor secretary can easily undo the Obama administration's worker protections, like making it possible for more workers to claim overtime. These were generally done by executive order. Michael McCann is a political science professor at the University of Washington. He says incoming Labor Secretary Andrew Pusder
hates unions and unionization. He's been an opponent of many of these things that the Obama administration has done.
The Trump administration can kill a rule with a stroke of a pen.
Or just non-enforcement.
But Washington's unions are powerful inside Washington state. Here, if your workplace has a union, you get fired if you don't join and pay the dues. Michael McCann.
If there was a piece of legislation that would really be disastrous for the labor movement, it would be national right to work legislation.
Then people wouldn't have to pay dues. That would erode the power of unions.
And certainly some Republicans have talked very seriously about that.
I would say the worst case scenario I've heard is that there could be serious threats to collective bargaining as soon as 2 years.
This is Nicole Grant of the MLK Labor Council.
It's prudent to be ready to fight in earnest for our rights as workers.
Workers helped bring Donald Trump to power, and they gave him a mandate to make change. I'm Carolyn Adolph, KUOW News.
On with the show. I'm Bill Radke. KUOW is having an ongoing conversation with Donald Trump supporters in Washington state to find out what they want from President Trump and how he's living up to their hopes. Peter Gigante and Jim Jensen are not only Trump voters, they were two of his biggest donors here. They are both listening to what critics are saying about the president-elect now, that he can't deliver on the big promises he made in the campaign. Peter Gigante was skeptical about that at first, too.
At first, I wasn't sure what to think. I knew he was unconventional. But somewhere along the line in the primary debates, I just thought, you know what? I think he has a better chance of winning than anybody else. And I think his policies are exactly what we need right now.
How about you, Jim?
Well, you know what? I was a little skeptical the first couple of weeks because, like many people, I thought maybe it was an advertisement plug for, you know, the next Apprentice or whatever. But after those first couple of weeks, he lost a couple hundred million dollars in endorsements. He just kept on going. And so that gained a lot of faith with me. See, he had skin in the game. His speeches, his pro-business thought, his business background. I'm a businessman. So to get a businessman into the White House has always been my dream, to be quite honest. I always felt like we would see a lot of efficiencies, a positive change, and a lot of business stimulus.
Jim, you've said Trump's talking about the silent majority. Why is the idea of the silent majority important to you?
For the last 8 years, you literally can say anything you want about a Republican. You can call him a racist. You can call him uneducated, ill-informed. You can call him a misogynist. You can call him a bigot. And it's no big deal. That's our label from the left constantly. And it was slowly over, I feel like, the last 8 years, the frustration level kept on building and building and building. And the media telling us the Republicans had no chance, I felt like, from really the beginning.
Peter, do you have a story of seeing frustration or feeling frustration yourself build up?
Yeah, I've been pretty frustrated the last 8 years. I don't feel that we've had the leadership in our country that we need, particularly on the three main issues that Trump stands for: our high corporate taxes resulting in corporate flight and leaving all of our jobs behind, the recognition that we live in a global environment and the need for our nation to be competitive on taxes, tougher immigration controls so that we become a country that actually has borders like every other country in the world, and lastly, trade. And Trump's been talking about trade for 30 years. In a way, it's more of a matter of the times changing to be aligned with what Trump has always stood for. It reminds me of Reagan in 1980. You know, he had the same message for 30 years, too. And then it was a matter of the stars becoming aligned and his message suddenly being brought to the forefront. Now it's very acutely felt by many Americans, particularly the working class.
Why do you think establishment Republicans and Democrats have been united on this idea of free trade, global trade for decades, that this is supposed to be a good thing for the U.S. economy?
Well, I'll quickly just run through my past. I grew up in Detroit. I went to graduate school in Michigan, and I saw firsthand the deterioration of the auto industry and Detroit's manufacturing base. So I've always been aware of this impact on the working class. You know, later I worked in Malaysia, which is a Muslim country. I worked in the Pacific Islands. I worked in China for 8 years. My wife is Chinese. My daughter's Chinese. I speak Chinese. I understand China very well. And in my view, it's really a matter of investor class versus working class. I think most of the people in power are members of the investor class. And they don't really, they look at GNP and they think everything's going great. They see, you know, low wages. So, you know, the service wages in the United States are low. Their cost of living's low. The prices are low because of imported goods. The profits on the S&P 500 are at record highs because of the overseas low-cost manufacturing. So if you're in the investor class and you're insulated from the day-to-day realities that the working class has to deal with, you think everything's going great. But the problem is that, you know, our country, our economy is based like is shaped like a pyramid. The bottom part of the pyramid is composed of the working class. It's the majority of the people are in the working class, and they don't have jobs. They don't have opportunities. Their wages are the same as they were 25 years ago. They're getting out of college. They can't find a job if they have a college degree. If they don't have a college degree, things are very, very, very tough for people. What's happening is the working class is becoming the underemployed class or the unemployed class. And so I think it was the working class that really swung this election. And I think it took a lot of people by surprise on the left and right who are members of the investor class who frankly didn't see it coming because they weren't really aware how acute the problem was becoming.
Has it been hard for you to be a Trump supporter
in
Western Washington?
I got it. Personally,
will you tell me a story?
Well, both my parents' cars are completely keyed up. I can tell you that from their Trump stickers on the back of their car. I had a friend of mine this weekend told me on his Trump sign there was a post-it note that said, "I'm going to come kill you and all your family. I'm second-generation Hispanic." The amount of violence that have come towards Trump supporters, I feel like, has not been publicized. I mean, there is—
But you don't think it's any worse on one side than another?
I think it's definitely worse on our—if you're a Trump supporter— There's endless videos of Trump supporters getting beat up, you know, on YouTube. If you just Google it, there's even a top 10 list, and it is scary.
Yeah, I don't think it's right to for people to feel embarrassed by their support of a major party candidate in our country. Not when half the country is supporting that person. I think it's people really feel afraid. They don't want to say that they support a certain candidate. We've taken political correctness to such an extreme that it makes people afraid to voice their opinion in public.
It's affecting. Has someone made you afraid?
It hasn't made me that afraid, but I haven't gone around,
flaunting it
that much. I mean, I
silent majority. You know.
Did you have any concerns about Trump as a candidate?
Well, I think I had the same concerns as everybody else. You know, I'm not too worried about the substance. It's more the way certain things are said with lack of preparation. You run the risk of offending people if you just speak in the way that your average guy on the street speaks to his buddy as they're walking down the road. You're going to invite problems. It is unfortunate that Trump's wording about the Mexican border came out the way it did, but I think his intention was just to draw attention to the fact that there is uncontrolled immigration at the border. And so you never know who you're getting. We do know we're getting criminals. We do know we're getting, it's a drug problem. We do know those things for a fact. We do know that there are repeat offenders who repeatedly get kicked out and come back in again as many as five times for crimes as serious as rape. We do know that this is happening.
People have been talking about controlling borders since I've been alive.
It's not racism to point out the problem. And you can't allow accusations of racism to turn a blind eye to the problem that really needs to be dealt with somehow.
And I personally don't have any problem with the working illegal immigrants in this country. I want the criminals gone. And I think we all can agree upon that.
Is Muslim immigration a hot button for either of you?
I'm anti-ISIS. I'm not anti-Muslim. I'm anti-Christian extremists as well. I wasn't a fan of David Koresh and was glad he was taken out, just like I was happy that Osama bin Laden was taken out. So
Muslim registry from Muslim countries?
I I would like a Muslim registry for ISIS sleeper cells and people that are fanatical.
Well, that's the hard part, right?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, but you can get pretty focused.
Having quotas is not anything new. You know, ever since the Immigration Department was created in 1892, I believe, we've had such things. Teddy Roosevelt spelled out our immigration policy very clearly. He said people shouldn't come here unless they share our values. That should be their reason for coming here.
So we've had a values questionnaire?
Yes, we need to address that because people who come here should come here because they accept our values, not because they have an intention to change our values. And having certain countries on non-entrance lists is nothing new either. We've done that in the past as well. It's been slackened off of in the last 8 years. Islam is obviously a religion, and it deserves the full protection under our laws, our freedom of religion. It deserves our respect. But radical Islam is not a religion. And the two need to be segregated, differentiated, because if you don't do that, if you turn a blind eye to that, what you're inadvertently allowing to happen is the spread of radical ideology under the protection that we afford greater Islam.
Do both of you think so far so good from the president-elect?
I love it. We have three women of color. We have one African-American, all appointed so far from Trump. I think he has.
Aren't those identity politics that conservatives get bite by?
You know what? I think they were great candidates that were appointed. And I think you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. If he would have not had any minorities, they would have said, what a racist. And then he appoints them and they say, oh, he's just trying to hide his racism.
So the cabinet, the his priorities, his tweets, whatever we've got so far, he's not president yet. What about you, Peter?
No, I think he's unconventional. I go back to people who supported Bernie Sanders in the state of Washington is heavily supported. Actually, you know, a lot of the things Bernie Sanders stood for, the problems he identified were spot on. But the solutions is where there's a great departure. You can't just wave a magic wand. What's happening, if the economic pie is shrinking, there's less money to go around. And so the way to correct that is to expand the economic pie, not to create money out of thin air for people.
Do either one of you have a personal story that captures how you've decided the way life works and what's important to you?
I work with city officials a lot in my business, and I've witnessed the firsthand the inefficiencies of government, the slows of government, the bureaucracy of government. And then I see the private sector act literally 180 degrees different than the public sector. They're working 18 hours a day, efficient, got to get the job done, go, 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 doing all the right things. Because if you're not, you go out of business. And unfortunately, in the government, you can't go out of business. You can't get fired most of the time.
I just want to dovetail off what he just said. And my biggest fear is socialism. I think if you look at Europe, 60% youth unemployment, the chickens are coming home to roost there. That's not a model for us to follow. What you're doing is you're encouraging a greater share of the electorate who are dependent upon government, people who are willing to sacrifice some of their opportunities and freedom in exchange for some financial security. And once that shift in the electorate occurs, we will forever be a socialist country from that point on, because the capitalists won't be able to have a say at the ballot box. The quality of life in our country is due to a vibrant private sector. Opportunity, innovation, technological advancement, all these things that made America great are because of the private sector's creativity. And people have hope and optimism for the future that the individual can do spirit.
Is there anything that President Trump, that you could see him realistically doing that would cost him your support? Are there any concerns you have that he better not go there?
I want him to be a straight shooter with no big issues. I don't want a Watergate, that's how he could lose my support, as if all of a sudden I was completely fooled and he's doing this all for just self-gain. He wants to get even richer, $16 billion or whatever he's worth is not enough. He wants $30 billion through just manipulating the government. I think there's about a 0.0001% chance of that happening, but that would do it.
Yeah. I think once you reach a certain point in your wealth accumulation, I don't think money does it for you anymore, especially when you're 70 years old. I think you're more concerned about your legacy and putting something back into the system. So I don't think he's going to ever get away from accusations that even are flying now about self-dealing and all that, because his businesses are so broad throughout the world. But is there anything he could do that would lose my support? Of course, there are things any president could do to lose my support, but I don't expect any of those things to happen.
Peter Gigante and Jim Jensen are Washington State supporters of Donald Trump. They also donated thousands to his campaign. And we are in this ongoing conversation with Trump supporters here to find out what they want from their new president and how he's living up to their hopes. We will keep that up into the new year and beyond. This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Here's something we learned from this year's election results. Or at least Crosscut reporter David Croman learned it when he visited Eastern Washington to find out why residents there went overwhelmingly Trump.
You know, it's so simple and cliche to a certain extent. It's almost annoying to say, but we just don't understand each other that well on either side of the mountain.
Okay. Western Washingtonians don't really get Eastern Washingtonians and vice versa. I think you may have already known that. So what do we do with that information? Do we just accept that's the way it is? Should we just make the mountains taller so we don't have to see each other? KUOW's social media producer, Bon Humerman, what do our listeners say?
Laura has some thoughts.
Yeah.
So she writes on our Facebook page, I'm a lifelong liberal who lives in Western Washington, but I have good relationships with plenty of conservatives, and I love Washington east of the mountains. Seems to me like we need some kind of exchange program. So people can rehumanize those from the, air quotes, other side.
Mm-hmm.
Seattleites, do you like to eat food, drink beer, live in houses built with lumber? Yeah, me too. Show some respect for the people who grow it and harvest it for you. On the other hand, Central and Eastern Washington folks, do you like the benefits of technology, video games, salmon, being able to order what you need online and have it delivered to your door? Show some respect for the people who make those things possible. Maybe if we thought more about the positive things we do for each other instead of what we don't like, we'd be better off. It's okay to be different, everybody. It takes all kinds.
Yes, it does. Well put, Laura. How about you? How would you bring Eastern and Western Washingtonians together? Have you ever tried it in the past? How'd that go? We would like to know, so please write in. To record@KUOW.org, that is, or give us a call, 206-221-3663, 221-3663. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Now we're going to talk about growth. Our Puget Sound area is growing, but we can't just build anywhere. We have boundaries. Like when you drive I-90 towards Snoqualmie Pass, you can see lush green forests on either side of the freeway. That land is protected from development. But sometimes communities decide it's time to develop, time to move those boundaries. KUOW's Joshua McNichol says this question of when to grow and when to restrict growth can lead to some hard decisions.
If you fly into Seattle at night, you can look down and see areas of light and areas of dark. There are exceptions, but for the most part, there's a pretty clear separation between what's urban and what's rural.
That just doesn't happen. That involves governments making hard choices.
That's King County Councilmember Rod Dembowski. He shows me a map in the latest edition of the county's comprehensive plan. There's a red polygon on the map that marks the line between urban and rural. In the city of Snoqualmie, the city wanted to move the line a little to make space for hotels, shopping, and affordable housing right next to Interstate 90.
Let's see here. This is the urban growth line. This side is urban, and this is rural. And so the pressure was make this urban and make this urban.
Rod Dembowski says Snoqualmie residents make a good argument, but their request was rejected.
We held the line here that time, and it's been very controversial.
I wanted to see the line for myself, so I drove up to Snoqualmie.
My name's Matt Larson. I'm the mayor with the city of Snoqualmie.
We walked the urban growth boundary together. Fresh snow fell around us.
A lot of interest groups and others that would say, oh, don't develop something like this, I haven't ever come out and actually looked at what the condition of the site is. I mean, standing here, if you stand still, it's pretty loud from the ambient noise of the freeway in the background. It's mostly blackberries and alders and scrappy. Most of the site's been logged. It was used as a RV park for years, and so it's not exactly pristine wilderness.
Larson is really frustrated with that urban growth boundary because he says there are little forest streams and really pretty areas that are worth protecting that are inside the growth boundary. He says, let's take those areas out of the urban growth area and protect them.
And say, hey, this area is not appropriate for urban growth. Let's take that out of the urban growth area. And here's another area that makes a lot more sense to put in the urban growth area. So you get a net zero. You've held the line, but you adjusted the line to achieve the same goal, but done it in a much smarter and effective way.
The mayor says some tasteful hotels on this parcel near Interstate 90 would help stimulate the tourist economy in Snoqualmie and bring in sales tax revenue. And if they could just build some affordable housing, maybe workers at the Salish Lodge wouldn't have to drive from places like South King County to get to work. The mayor says the urban growth boundary puts that dream out of reach.
It makes me feel like we're caught in kind of a situation where ideology is driving land use decisions and not good common sense. I mean, this is stuff that was drawn on a napkin, you know, 20, 30 years ago. It just makes sense that we revisit some of it.
King County Councilmember Rod Dombowski acknowledges Mayor Larson's compelling argument. But he says if you let the growth boundary move in one place, it would start to fall apart everywhere.
You look at other counties. If you go, for example, to Snohomish County, I don't think they have the long history of being as rigid as we have been with our line. But I think this region as a whole appreciates what we've done.
That can lead to some hard feelings in places like Snoqualmie.
That's going to be a little bit of a festering sore.
And it's not just Snoqualmie. The urban growth boundary held in every place where it was challenged during this year's rewrite of the County Comprehensive Plan. The next chance to revisit the boundary will be in 2020. In Snoqualmie, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
It's KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke, and I'm just saying, it's December 13th. And in case you could use a gift for a youngster, Seattle book lover Nancy Pearl is here to help.
This is called The Christmas Crocodile. It's written by one of Seattle's wonderful picture book writers, Bonnie Becker, and illustrated by arguably one of the top five illustrators in the country, if not the world, David Small. And this is the last of the Book Crush rediscoveries. So this is a book that came out in 1998, went out of print, and we brought it back into print. And it's just a perfect book.
The Christmas Crocodile?
The Christmas Crocodile. So it's set in the Victorian period. And Alice Jane finds a crocodile under the tree on Christmas Eve. And this crocodile doesn't mean to be bad, but just sort of can't help it.
Is this a gift crocodile?
Yes, this is a gift crocodile.
Somebody gave her a crocodile as a gift?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And everybody has a different idea of what to do for the crocodile.
I'm looking at the pictures.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So there's dialogue. There's Alice Jane, and then the various people that she's speaking with,
right,
and the dialogue between them is in between their two pictures.
Yes.
That's a clever way of doing it.
It is. It's, you know, the best picture books are when the pictures and the text mesh perfectly, when there's enough room in the text for the artist to express what he or she is seeing there. And this is one of those books. It's a fabulous, funny book, and it ends with a terrific, again, it has just a wonderful, wonderful surprise ending that will just be fun, I think, for parents and children to read together.
I always wonder what age child picture books are aimed at. I really enjoy them, and I'm not a child anymore. That was long in the rearview mirror. So who are they written for?
I think they're written for children. I think this is written for not 2 and 3 year olds. This is a definite story. So I would say this is for 4 and 5 year olds, maybe kids who are beginning to read on their own, starting to read. People who love Frog and Toad, that Arnold Lobel series, I think would enjoy this. But this, on every page, there's something to point out with the illustrations. And the story just carries you along as Alice Jane's family tries to decide what they're going to do with this crocodile who doesn't mean to be bad.
Is there something innately funny about crocodiles? There was a book that I remember reading to my son called Lyle, Lyle Crocodile. What is it about crocodiles?
I think they're for an illustrator, I think their expressions can't be beat. I mean, I remember Lyle, Lyle Crocodile as well. But this crocodile, when he's happily eating some of the other Christmas presents or whatever, just the look on his face is enough to make you smile.
I think that's a perfect thing for anybody's holiday, under the tree or over the mantle or wherever. The Christmas Crocodile by Bonnie Becker and illustrated by David Small. And you'll know when you find this book because not only is this the Book Crush Revisited part of the series, the last in the series, but this particular crocodile's got Christmas ribbon hanging from his mouth. And just, that is enough to make us laugh. Nancy Pearl, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marcy.
Every week, Nancy Pearl talks to KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman about books. And you'll find all of Nancy's recommendations at KUOW.org. Our next guest, Carrie Egan, knows a lot about death, beginning from a young age when she lost her father to complications from diabetes.
He had really been sick my whole life. So I was in some ways not afraid of sickness. I had sort of been around it. And at the same time, I was terrified of it because, you know, my dad had died.
Facing that fear of death is what led Carrie Egan to become a hospice chaplain. She put herself right in it with people at the end of life, sat down with them, listened to their stories, and found out what their religion means or does not mean to them. Her book about what she's learned is called On Living.
Every person who's dying is as different as they were when they were alive. So everybody's going to have really different needs. If I were to sort of say anything broadly, it's that people are trying to make meaning out of their lives. And that's kind of like a real chaplaincy term, you know, meaning making, that you've had these experiences in life, including this one of dying, which is, you know, one of the experiences of living that we'll all go through. And how does that make sense? How does that match up or not match up with what you've been taught? You know, religion isn't just sort of what you learn in church. It's the entire way you organize the world. It's how you imagine the world. Sometimes those beliefs are really helpful and sometimes they're really harmful, but we all sort of imagine the world in a certain way. We all have certain assumptions that the world functions in a certain way. So you have this system of beliefs about how the world works, and then you have these experiences that we go through in life, and a lot of times they don't match up. You know, you have the belief, you know, that if you do the right thing and you're a good person, good things should happen to you. And we all know that's not true. I mean, there was that famous book about that, right?
Bad things happening to good people.
That was written by a rabbi who had really bad things happen to his family, to his son. He was very, very sick.
Can you tell me why bad things happen to good people?
No.
Oh, rats.
I don't know why. Oh. I wish I did. I really wish I did know why. I just know that it does.
How do you facilitate somebody's making meaning in this life?
So sometimes these hard things that just don't match up, they just don't match up with what they thought was real, with what they thought was true. Sometimes they can barely even talk about it. And so sometimes to sit with someone who sort of is a representative of religion, faith, spirituality, God, whatever they're sort of projecting onto you as the chaplain, to sit with that person and even just tell the story. Sometimes that is the most revolutionary thing, is to say, this happened to me and I don't understand it. Sometimes that is enough of a breakthrough. But what I think is really important is that people go on living and can recover and find meaning even from really awful things. They don't come out the same on the other side. You know, we're all changed by the experience of living. But things that you might think no one could recover from, people do.
Like what? Give me an example.
Being raped by your father, being, you know, a punching bag to your spouse.
And people are coming to grips with these things in hospice.
Yes. Killing someone. Sure. Oh, yeah. The stories. Yeah. Yes.
And how do you facilitate somebody coming to grips and making meaning out of something like that?
Out of any one of those things? Well, the first thing you do is you listen. and you don't tell them what it means. Because that's the first impulse people have. Shut it down. They don't want to be around it. It's too hard. It's even hard for the listener. And the second impulse is to tell someone what it means. I would never say to anyone, God never gives you more than you can handle. Oh, goodness, your four-year-old died. But you can handle it because God doesn't give people more than they can handle. Well, that's just brutal. That's awful. You're telling someone God made your four-year-old die, but, you know, suck it up. You can handle it. That's a terrible thing to tell someone. Now, if they say it for themselves, it might really give them a lot of strength. But they have to say that for themselves.
I'm talking with Carrie Egan, who is a former hospice chaplain, and she's written a book called On Living. Carrie, are there certain patients whose stories stay with you?
Oh, there's one patient who, in the book, I call her Gloria. So she had a baby out of wedlock in a very difficult situation. She was going to give the baby up for adoption, and she went to an unwed mother's home. And, you know, this was in South Carolina in you know, the 1950s. This is, you know, a very different world. So she went to an unwed mother's home, and she was going to give the baby up. And she got home the next day after giving birth and her parents' home. And she said, I had a panic attack and I realized I had done the wrong thing. I had to get my baby back. And I told my parents and they kicked her out of the house. And she went to her friends and nobody would take her in. And finally, her grandmother said, I will help you. And she had to sell everything because she had to pay back the home for all of the care she had gotten. So room and board for 6 months and, you know, the doctors and nurses and the hospital stay. They said, well, that's fine, but then you have to pay it all back. And so she sold everything she had. You know, she kept one dress and a pair of shoes and that was it. And she got the baby back. But then she never told him because she was so ashamed. There was so much shame back then for having an out of wedlock child. And here she was dying and she had never told him. And so she considered this the greatest thing she had ever done in her life, the bravest thing she had ever done. And so when she was telling this story, I mean, I really felt like I was there. Like I understood how terrifying this decision was, like how much strength, how much bravery it took to say to her parents in that world, you know, at that time, I'm going to have this child and I'm going to raise this child and I'm not going to pretend it didn't happen. You know, I'm not going to keep it a secret. But then she turned around, she did keep it a secret. She never told her son. And so the reason she even told me the whole story is she says, my son doesn't know that his father, so the man I married when the baby was two, he doesn't know that that's not his father. And my husband never loved him right. And he never knew why. And I knew why, but I never told him. And he always thought there was something wrong with him. He always thought there was something really, really deeply wrong with him that his father didn't love him the right way. And he could see that his father loved him differently than he loved his brothers and sisters. And he never knew why. And I want him to know before I die. I want him to know. So call him up and tell him.
Oh my God.
And I said, I really don't think I can do that. I think you need to do that. He doesn't even know me. Could you imagine getting that phone call from some stranger? Like, I'm your mom's chaplain. And I just want to let you know your father is not your father. I mean, and I said, I can't, you have to tell him. And her big fear was that her son wouldn't think it was a good thing.
Right.
Her big fear was that her son would say, I wish you had given me up for adoption and yeah. that somebody else had raised me. Because he'd had a hard life too.
Yeah. And what happened?
Well, she told her son and it went well.
It did?
It did. Oh, and I feel like that's kind of, I feel like that's the son's story now. I don't tell the story beyond that. I keep that private.
Did that resolve her spiritual crisis?
It did. And a lot of, you know, sometimes I've had people say, well, you know, what does religion have to do with this? And I think for someone like Gloria, this was very much a religious question. Maybe not at first, but, you know, she was coming from a Christian background. And the basic tenet in Christianity, you know, is that God is love. And so she has this enormous love for her son that she literally was willing to give up. I mean, the way she tells it, you know, the fear and trembling 60 years later was still so on the surface. The incredible leap she had to take to say, this is what I'm doing. I'm going against every convention I have, including the religious conventions I was brought up with. And I'm going to follow love, right? This sense of love I have. It's hard to really fully explain how brave she was that she was able to do this. And so one of the ways she built understanding was I would talk with her about, well, what have your other experiences of love been? And yes, your religious background, your church taught you that you should be very ashamed of this. But, you know, she loved the Bible. What does the Bible say about love? We talked about, well, what does it mean to love someone? And what have your experiences of love been? What does your religion teach you about love? Eventually, she got the strength to do it.
How does it affect you being around all this death?
Okay, so this is going to sound paradoxical, but it's true. I think I'm happier and I'm a better person when I'm working as a chaplain. And I think I'm happier because when you're constantly reminded that this little bit of time on earth, it's really short. You know, I've had people like 100 years old say to me, I just thought I was going to have more time.
100 years old.
Yeah, they're 100 years old. And they're like, I know that sounds ridiculous. I just really thought I was going to have more time. And so when you hear that and you're constantly reminded like, oh, this time is short. So many people like you walk around and your life is really good. I think it makes me more appreciative of sort of where I am and what I am.
I need some advice, Chaplain.
Sure.
How should we live and die?
I don't do advice.
No?
You know what? People, and it's not even like, oh, you need to figure it out for yourself. Like, I have full faith because I've seen it some million times. I mean, that's a good question, though. That's a good question for anybody even listening. Like, take a second and actually stop and think, what do I really want? Like, what do I want in life? Like, when I get to the end, what did I want it to be about? You can ask that right now. Are there anybody in your life right now you need to reconcile with? Is there anything you want to do? You can ask those questions right now. You don't have to wait till you're dying to do it.
Words from author Carrie Ian, a former hospice chaplain, and her new book is called On Living. KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information. The president-elect doesn't seem to feel warmly about the tech innovation that drives our Puget Sound economy. Trump once advocated, quote, closing up that internet in some way. Well, maybe that can change. Today, Bill Gates met with Trump in New York City.
We had a good conversation about innovation, how it can help in health, education, impact of foreign aid and energy, and a wide-ranging conversation about the power of innovation. Thank you.
Former Microsoft leader Bill Gates. Tomorrow, a group of America's other prominent tech leaders is also reportedly heading to New York for a Trump meeting. Let's find out more from the co-founder of the Seattle tech news site GeekWire, Todd Bishop. Welcome back.
Thank you, Bill.
This group of tech leaders is truly a who's who, so who?
Many. Jeff Bezos, Satya Nadella, the Microsoft CEO, Sheryl Sandberg, the Facebook COO, Elon Musk, the SpaceX and Tesla leader, just a really, as you said, a who's who. This is truly a summit of some of the biggest minds in innovation in the United States.
Imagine the security in this room.
Yes.
Is it fair to say that tech leaders generally opposed Trump during the campaign?
If you look at contributions and public statements, yes. Many of these leaders or many leaders in the tech industry said that Trump would be a disaster for innovation. Many of them contributed their personal funds to the Hillary Clinton campaign. So certainly there is not a coziness between Donald Trump and many of these people he'll be meeting with tomorrow.
What is Trump's attitude toward tech companies?
Trump seems to be primarily interested in jobs and the U.S. economy, whereas the Obama administration, the source of tension, was largely about data privacy and surveillance. You remember Edward Snowden and all of those issues that came up then, and many of the tech companies resisted the Obama administration's efforts to get data about their customers. Trump, on the other hand, is, as you would expect, primarily focused on the economy. It seems like there'll be a lot of discussion about China and jobs, U.S. manufacturing. So a lot more direct issues related to the economy.
Although he does use Twitter.
Yes.
You know that.
This is absolutely true. He may not be fully familiar with how the internet works, as you would glean from someone saying that he could just close up the internet, which he asked for Bill Gates' help on that, by the way, during the campaign.
Gates' help closing up the internet?
Yeah, he said, let's get Bill Gates on that.
Okay.
That was the gist. But he obviously is very familiar with the modern tools of communication, and particularly at 3 a.m, he's quite effective at it.
You mentioned Jeff Bezos, the head of Amazon, who Trump seems to dislike. What's going on there?
Bezos, if you'll recall, is also the owner, personally, of the Washington Post, which has not been flattering, has been very direct and tough in its coverage of Trump throughout the campaign. If you recall, the Washington Post was actually the site and newspaper that broke the story of Trump on the Access Hollywood bus before it could be broken by NBC. So there are some hard feelings. And in fact, essentially, Trump has said that Bezos uses the Post for influence in Washington, D.C. to benefit Amazon. So some tension there, although they've somewhat made up. Bezos said he's willing to give the president the benefit of the doubt and the president-elect. And it seems to be largely smoothed over at this point.
How about Trump and Microsoft? How do they get along?
You know, it's, for the most part, so far, it seems like they're getting along okay. Microsoft was pretty conciliatory in its initial messaging after Trump was elected, as were many of the other technology executives. I think it was kind of an oh-no moment where they realized, I guess like many of the other country, like many other people in the country, suddenly this person that they've been criticizing is going to be running things. Microsoft, it's fascinating because they've actually had a very tough relationship with the Obama administration. They are suing the Department of Justice over what are essentially gag orders, where the DOJ asks for information about customers and then simultaneously tells Microsoft they can't tell the customers that the government's asking for the information. They're fighting over a server in Ireland. So I don't even know if any of that is on Trump's agenda. I don't even know if he's aware of it, which is kind of creates an interesting dynamic. It seems like this will largely be a one-sided conversation where Trump lays out his agenda. I could imagine, though, that from this might emerge some sort of tech advisory board. To me, that seems like the most tangible outcome because you're really not going to accomplish much in a day or an hour or a couple hours, however long they're going to meet.
How about the issues of tech companies wanting more highly skilled workers from overseas and Trump's thoughts on immigration? Do you know where those come together or don't?
Absolutely. So the H-1B visa program is used heavily by Microsoft, Amazon, other technology companies to bring in skilled engineers on visas to work on projects here in the United States. There have been caps on that program from the government. Microsoft and others have advocated, you know, raising those caps to allow more workers in. But certainly, given Trump's stance on immigration and his past comments, that's in conflict with what these tech companies would want. I would not be surprised if that was a topic of discussion tomorrow.
Just in our final minute here, Todd, who does Trump resent more, Jeff Bezos or Apple?
That's a great question. Now, he said he needs to get Apple to, can I say the D word on the radio? He needs to get Apple to basically build their computers in the United States. So it's a good question. I think it's pretty much a toss-up at this point.
Okay, so we'll just watch and wait to see what this conversation is like between Trump and the tech super friends.
Absolutely. The other subplot you've got is Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos are going to be there. You've got commercial space and NASA. I mean, there are so many.
Right, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, it's like a little soap opera with all these different subplots that are going to be going on tomorrow.
All right, the cast of characters in Manhattan tomorrow, and telling you about it is from Seattle's tech news site GeekWire, our friend Todd Bishop. Todd, good to see you again.
Thank you, Bill.
KUOW. We're on Twitter, of course, at KUOW, and join us on Facebook and write into us. We'd like to hear your thoughts on what we've covered today. Record at KUOW.org. Thanks for listening.